Hello and welcome to the V2 Big Interview with myself, Anthony Kendrick. My guest for this week is Seth Burkett, who's a former footballer and is now a football writer. He's written several books, including The Boy in Brazil, which details his time in Brazil, and recently another book called No Final Whistle. A very interesting guy to talk to. We spoke about the transfer deadline day being moved to earlier in August, about English players playing abroad and several other topics, as well as his own career. So I recorded that interview with Seth the day before transfer deadline day, and I'm recording this intro now following the deadline, and there's no signings for Manchester United, or more crucially Tottenham perhaps, the only side in the top five European leagues not to sign a single player, and also the first side ever in the Premier League since the summer transfer window was introduced not to sign a player. So quite surprising that Everton made a triple signing of Mina, Bernard and Gomez, should strengthen them massively. Also, you've got the news that Joe Bryan has eventually settled on Fulham and not Aston Villa, despite Steve Bruce allegedly chasing him down the motorway. But anyway, I hope you enjoy the interview and this week's show. Just also a quick mention, you can follow us on Twitter at V2 Sport Network, follow myself at Ant underscore Kendrick, and also Seth Burkett at Seth Burkett.
Emil Heskey, could it be five? Yes, it is! Frank De Boer singing out Dennis Bergkamp. Oh, that's brilliant! Oh, that's wonderful! That is a magnificent goal!
My guest for this week's episode is former footballer and now writer Seth Burkett.
Hi, Anthony, how are you doing?
Yeah, good, thank you. Good, thanks. Glad to get you on the show tonight.
Thanks for having me.
No worries. So I want to go back to sort of the start of your career, I suppose, for want of a better word. You went to Peterborough as a youngster. How did that come about?
Yeah, so I was 8 years old when I first signed for Peterborough. My parents didn't really want me to play competitive football. They just wanted me to kind of, you know, have a bit of fun of it. So at first, I was just playing at school. Then I went to a fun day. You know, all professional clubs hold them. They're a bit of a money-making scheme. And at the fun day, one of the coaches saw me and said, oh, you should come play for our development centre. So my parents started taking me at the age of six to this weekly development centre. And I did well there. Got invited to trial for the academy when I was 8 years old. And, did well enough in the trials to be signed up for them, which was, yeah, absolutely amazing for me, because I had a season ticket to Peterborough. I was going there every week to watch them. And then all of a sudden to be able to represent them and play for them every week was fantastic for me as an 8-year-old kid.
Presumably Peterborough were your local side at that time.
Yeah, it's just 20 minutes down the road. So I mean, for me, they're like Man United. They're massive.
how long did you stay at Peterborough for?
So I was there 2 years, then got released, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I was. It's obviously really unfortunate. It kind of came out of the blue. I thought I'd been doing quite well, but unfortunately the coaches didn't agree.
Yeah.
They said, unfortunately, we don't think you're good enough, and it was like my world ended. It really was, because until that moment, I'd found myself by playing for Peterborough, and I was, you know, Seth, Peterborough United player. That's how everyone knew me. And then all of a sudden, I was just Seth.
I saw on Twitter you posted the letter of what they sent you when they released you. There was a bit of disagreement, I noticed, on whether people thought that was sort of an acceptable thing or whether it was a decent letter, I suppose. I guess at the time you must have just felt heartbroken. But looking back on it now, do you think they treated you fairly, like, you know, as you left? Or do you think...
I think they did and they didn't. I think the coaches at the academy really cared. They genuinely did. And, you know, no one really likes to release a player. And it obviously is a bad time for the coach to do that. And the letter itself was constructive. You know, they gave me some advice about what I could do to get to a stage where I could become a professional footballer. They gave me hope, saying that I was my Peterborough, because at the time they were one of the best coaches in the country. They really were. Again, it gave me hope by saying, look, you might not be right for us, but we're sure you can get into Northampton, Cambridge, for example. I did get into Northampton as well. That was my next team. So it was constructive, but then there's a lot that could have been improved. Like I said, it came out of the blue. I think kind of communicating that to me a bit in advance, or kind of readying me almost. So
I think having those conversations with the parents, maybe a few months before their release, they get the parents in and say, look, you know, your son's at risk. Please just be aware this may happen.
Yeah.
I think that would really help. I think there's other things they can do in academies. The pressure I found was enormous, and I think a lot of that stems from there only being short-term contracts. All the players in the team, the contracts were just 12 months long. So it means you're always nervous kind of about being released. And I think having a minimum of a two-year contract would kind of show a commitment to players and a commitment to develop them, both on the behalf of the coach and the player. But like I say, the coaches really do care. I actually bumped into the guy who was heading up the academy. So he didn't ever really work directly with me, but he knew who I was. And this was 20 years ago this was happening. I bumped into him last year at St George's Park, and he said, oh, Seth, how are you doing? Yeah, your dad's in Virginia, your mum's called Claire. Yeah, they're from Stamford. And he just remembered everything. And I think that really hit home to me about how much they really do care.
Yeah. So you would have been, what, 10 at that time when you were released?
Yes, yeah.
Do you think that maybe that's a bit young for, like, children to have to deal with rejection? It's more of a general question rather than you personally, perhaps, but do you think maybe clubs should be more mindful of the fact that, you know, there's such young players and, you know, in some cases even younger than that getting signed up?
I'm gonna kind of sit on the fence again, because it is and it isn't. I think at that age, it really is a lot to take. I think ideally it would probably be secondary school age where you have news as big as that impacting you. On the flip side of that, I think being released at that age was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. I think it absolutely breaks your world, and it's really hard to bounce back from. But once you do bounce back and realise actually, you know, you'll still get another chance, maybe get an opportunity elsewhere. I think it really teaches you resilience, and kind of I go into schools now and do talks about writing, about football. I say it's about the power of losing, and I always learn so much more about life and, you know, about how to improve when I lost than when I won. Being released at that young age, it teaches you the power of resilience and to not be afraid of failure almost. So I look at a lot of players who I played with throughout youth careers who are absolutely fantastic, really, really good players, should be playing at the highest level now, and they aren't, because when they got to 16 or 18 they got released, and until that point all they'd known was success. So to suddenly have that failure was just literally it for them, and the vast majority of people that happen to aren't even playing football anymore. So I think actually getting that really bad news at a young age and having that setback helped me in the long term. I think will help others in the long term. What's most important is that if you are going to release a player at that age, you just have to make sure they have the support network in place that will enable them to bounce back in the future.
Mm-hmm. It must be a sort of challenging job for a coach, I must imagine. On one hand, you have to sort of manage expectations and, you know, say that some of the kids, youngsters will be released, but then on the other hand you don't want to you sort of ruin kids' dreams of playing in the Premier League or playing for England or, you know, whatever their dream may be.
Yeah, exactly. It's a really hard job, and in England coaches are really underpaid. The salary they give coaches in academies is outrageous. It really is. You know, coaches aren't in it for the money with that salary. Now that I'm older, I can kind of see the bigger picture and see how much they cared and how it was such a hard job. But at the time when I got released, you can't see that at all. And you, I wouldn't say you hate the coach, but you really want to, you get really driven on to prove them wrong, and you think badly of them for quite a while until you are able to see the bigger picture and see that, you know, this wasn't them getting any pleasure out of it. It's something they had to do. And yeah, I really do sympathise with them.
Yeah, I know I've spoken to others on this podcast before about English coaches, the coaching system not being very well set up compared to a lot of European countries. Is that something you feel strongly about?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, it's very hard to argue at the moment with the success of the England youth teams. I think what we're always told was that my age group, we're the first ones to have been able to go through the whole academy system from start to finish. I think it was only set up as of around 98, 99 maybe. So it has taken a while to kind of see the benefits of that system, and as we say, we really are seeing the benefits now. The success of the English teams, I mean, there's some really good players coming through. And I mean, countries train their players in very different ways. As you know, I played in Brazil. There, the training is very, very different to the way that players are trained in England, and both have benefits and both have negatives. I think there are improvements that can be made, but I think England's getting a lot right at the moment with the way it develops players.
Okay. After Peterborough, you mentioned Northampton, and where did you go before you went on to Brazil? What was sort of your journey from there?
So I went to Northampton. I picked up quite a few injuries there. I managed to dislocate my elbow, I think, four times in three seasons, which saw me being released. I went and played Sunday League football for a season after that for Deeping Rangers. That was interesting for me because whilst playing in an academy, I mentioned it previously about the pressure. And the pressure was there every week. You know, after every game, you'd be getting match marks. Six was academy stand. If you got less than a six, you start to sweat and worry about being released. So it meant that you could never really enjoy football. You know, there's always pressure. I remember I always used to enjoy training, but when it came to matches, I just really felt that pressure. So coming to play Sunday League was kind of a real release, and it made me realise that actually football is fun and it's really enjoyable. And I was suddenly able to express myself, and it was honestly the best, most enjoyable season I've ever had playing football. And you know, enjoying myself meant that I was got to a stage of my ability where I was improving again, and my son for Peterborough United again. Stayed there till I was 16, got released again. I was playing centre back at the time. They said that I was too small to be a centre back. So fortunately had to move on and went to Stamford, my local non-league team, where I signed for the under-18 team. And I started to play with the first team at the same time. And that's when the Brazil opportunity came about, in my second season of the under-18 team there.
I saw you ended up mostly playing as a fullback sort of later on in your career, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, so I mean, after being told that I'd be too small to be a centre-back in by Peterborough, I immediately changed to left-back when I moved to Stamford, because being too small to 16, playing against other 16-year-olds meant that, you know, playing up against 18-year-olds, and I was also playing Stamford against, you know, full-grown men, it meant that I definitely couldn't hold my own as a centre-back. So I saw it as kind of a way around being able to play men's football, and went and played left-back and actually moved forwards and ended up playing left wing, centre midfield, all sorts in men's football, and actually had quite a few games as a sweeper. So I started off in left back, but yeah, moved all over the pitch really.
It's quite interesting how the fullback position's changed, like from a left back and a right back being expected to be good defensively, whereas now it's more important that they're faster players and, you know, can get up and deliver a good cross into the box. It's quite amazing how much it's changed in not a long period of time.
Yeah, and that difference is really magnified when I went to Brazil as well, because in the under-18 team at Stamford, I was encouraged to get forwards. They played quite a nice little, but you know, when I started playing for the adult team, they're playing in, you know, the Unibond League, it was at the time, Unibond League. You're playing against some horrible teams who, you know, it's guys who are literally getting their money to eat for the week. And yeah, they're doing anything they can to win. You have to go long ball. So that was kind of I wasn't able to express myself so much. It's kind of don't go past halfway line, hit the channels with long balls, and your primary job is to defend. And then when I got to Brazil, it was totally the opposite as a fullback, and it was don't go into your own half, stay in the opposition half, attack whenever you can. The only training for position specific stuff I did as a fullback was either shooting or crossing. So that really kind of magnified the change. And then when I got back from Brazil, it started to develop the fullback role, and even in non-league football in England, to become, as you mentioned, that player who can defend and attack.
So you went over to Brazil when you were 18. You were there as part of a pre-season.
Yeah, so this is where I got really lucky in that in my second season of playing for the under-18 team, there was a Brazilian guy who started to watch our games, and it was quite exotic really, because we had, you know, 10, 20 people, the typical old man and his dog watching us. So to have this mystery Brazilian man in the stands was a real talking point. There was lots of rumours saying, oh, he's a scout, he's an agent. And it turned out he was an agent. He was representing to Nilsson, who was playing at Arsenal at the time. And he started to become more involved with the club. And he said, look, I've got an opportunity to go to Brazil at the end of the season for a tour. Do you fancy it? And of course, all us under-18s said, yeah, absolutely. It was subsidised for us, so we needed to cover the flights. And it was amazing. We got to the airport, we were just mobbed by media. There was, you know, radio guys, TV cameras, all sorts, just photographers. I can understand why there was such a kind of, like, yeah, had they got the right team? Like, why are they doing it? And it turned out that we were to play against the national team the next day. We had the Brazil under 18 team in the same tournament as in the same group as us. So the next day we found ourselves on the same pitch as Coutinho and other players, and they beat us 8-0 in front of 8,000 people.
Yeah, that must have been an absolutely incredible experience to play in front of that sort of crowd. And well, did Coutinho stand out for you at the time? Was he someone you were sort of aware of?
Yeah, we were all aware of him. Anderson, the agent, pointed him out to us because he just signed for Inter Milan, I think, for £7.5 million. When he scored a hat-trick, so he was pretty tasty.
So after that, you signed up for Sorriso. I hope I pronounced that right.
I don't know how to pronounce it, to be honest. I think Sorriso, which translates to smile, actually. That's the Portuguese word for smile. Oh. And again, I just got really fortunate in that as part of the deal for us in the tournament, that five or six of the lads from the team trained with a team called Vitória, who at the time were playing in the top division of Brazilian football. Mm. They're probably a mid-table team, so similar stature to a Fulham, I'd say. And we trained their under 18 team, and about halfway through our training week with them, the manager came to me and said, "Look, my left back's been called up for Brazil's under 18 team, under 19, I think it was, and we need left back for a friendly tomorrow." He said, "You know, you've been doing quite well in training. Can you come cover for us?" Yeah. So I absolutely jumped at the chance and said, yeah, 100%. The next day I found myself playing left back for Vitória, and we were playing against a US touring team. It's quite a simple game, to be honest. We won 2-0. I did okay. And there was a guy watching who obviously agreed, because he was to coach a team for the following season, and he asked me if I wanted to come and play for them, which again, I absolutely jumped at the chance. The team was Sorriso. They were playing in the Copa São Paulo, which was the equivalent of the Brazilian FA Youth Cup. And so 4 months after then, in October, I think, of 2009, I found myself flying out to Sorriso.
And you were 18 at the time, I believe.
Yeah, 18, yeah.
So that must have been a big, you know, for you personally, like putting all the football to one side to move to Brazil, and that must have been a big thing for you personally.
Oh, it was a massive culture shock. You know, quite a comfortable middle-class existence in England. Then I was, you know, suddenly found myself... so the player accommodation was very, very basic. They put all the team up in the same place. It's called Casa dos Filtros, which means House of Filters, and it was literally a converted garage. So the football club had bought this garage on the cheap and split it into a few rooms. So there's 3 bedrooms for 28 of us. The walls were, you know, the walls weren't painted bare. The windows were barred. There's no doors in the toilets. The shower's just a concrete block. The beds, I mean, my room, I got to be the best room, because as an English person, I was real kind of interest to the Brazilians.
Yeah.
So I got treatment. But, you know, we had 6 people in my room, and the room itself was smaller than the bedroom I had at home. The bedroom opposite us was bigger, but had 14 people in there, 7 beds. So, I mean, going from, you know, nice existence in England to that was a real eye-opener. And, yeah, it was next to favelas, it was filthy. And it was now my home.
You must have formed a great bond with your fellow players, though, all of you together in that sort of situation.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I first got there, I didn't speak a word of Portuguese. I tried to use this, and no one spoke English. So it's kind of the first evening, it's a bit, no one knew what to do. And then they just started to try and swear in English and teach me the swear words in Portuguese, and that's how we bonded.
How's your Portuguese now? Not that I'm going to test you.
Yeah, not bad. I mean, my swearing is really good. And I got to the stage in Brazil where I could probably get by conversation. I could hold my own and kind of, yeah, speak to people as long as they spoke slowly. And yeah, I made some really good friends, and friends that, 8 years on, I still speak to now.
That's fantastic. So your actual time there, what were sort of the highlights of it for you?
The people, I mean, the Brazilians are absolutely incredible. They're so welcoming. They're so... fun-loving, always positive, always optimistic. It meant that there was never a dull moment. Even little things like just getting the bus to training, and there'd be people dancing down the aisles, playing the water bottles as drums. You know, sound music was there all the time. So that was a real highlight for me. Also, just the Brazilian style of football was fantastic. It's everything you expect. It's very skillful, lots of flair, even on absolutely terrible pitches. And just, it's just really infectious the way that Brazilians approach life. Really, really positive. And that was certainly the best thing I took out of my experience.
Mm-hmm. I saw that you released the book The Boy in Brazil, which is all about your time there.
Yes, that was we had 13 training sessions a week leading up to Copa São Paulo. We had Sunday afternoons off, but the training schedule would be, you know, leave training at 8:30, you get back about 11:30 in the morning. Mm. Then you deep lunch, have a bit of rest and have a proper siesta. Then you wake up again at 4 and go back to training until, say, 7:30. Then it'd be lights out. Again, you have a shower, have dinner, and it'd be lights out about 11:00. So there was a lot of sleeping, but also because normally English, a lot of downtime.
Yeah.
So in that time, I decided to just keep a diary. And that's my time in Brazil progressed, and just really crazy stuff started to happen with really crazy people. When I got back, I looked at my notes and thought, yeah, this is actually quite interesting when I write it up as a book.
Mm.
And that's where Brazil came from.
Did you any interest in writing before, or did it just sort of...
Yeah, there was. My gran's an author, so she's always kind of got me to write. And all throughout school, my two best subjects were always PE and English. So I'd always been into writing. When I turned 16, my gran got me to help her out on a book that she was writing called Hobby. She came on the cover, even though what I did was minimal.
Mm.
But even so, I'd always wanted to write a book, and so it seemed like the perfect opportunity.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I presume it was another option for you if football didn't work out, you know, say as a teenager or something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, at that point, even coming back from Brazil, I was really starting to think that football would work out for me.
Mm-hmm.
When I got released from Northampton, they said to me, look, we could keep you on till you're 16 because you're not the worst in the team, but really we think it's a waste because you don't have the physique probably to be a professional footballer, but you know, you're okay at school, so we think it's best for you if you focus on your academics. So after then, I hadn't ever really expected to be a footballer, but then... Obviously, the Brazil option came about, and I improved a lot out in Brazil. You could not improve with the sound of players out there. Mm-hmm. When I got back to England, I thought, oh, maybe I can actually have a go at this football. Maybe, you know, I can probably get into a League One, League Two team. And I'd had nothing. I tried through some agents, but I couldn't even get a trial anywhere. So I kind of had to reassess my options quite quickly after then.
Mm. What's the media interest been like in you at the time? I saw when you were in Brazil there was a fair bit, but was it coming back from Brazil, was there much or?
Yeah, it was crazy in Brazil especially. I had a little bit when I went out, as you know, it's in the non-league paper because I've been playing a bit for Stamford first, and then so it's in the non-league paper. Locally it was as well. And then the Brazilian media started to pick up because on my first day there I got whisked into the local TV's chose to do piece. And as Copa São Paulo came back, it really ramped up. The Copa São Paulo is on their equipment with Sky Sports. You know, every single day there was games on. They had a kind of studio guest talking about it. And for them, the main story was this guy from England's come all the way to play in it. So there's a lot of media attention on me until the first game when they realised actually I wasn't that good. But that media attention also got picked up in England, and I remember in the January of 2010, a news agency, my dad was a head teacher at the time, and he found this guy snooping around his school, and it turned out he was looking to complete his story on me. And the next day, the news broke in some of the papers, and you know, after that, I did all radio stations from Brazil. It was in a bit of it's in a lot of newspapers, and the same back. And then when I released The Boy in Brazil, once again, it got in quite a good media coverage.
And sort of brings us full circle to now, because I've seen you've been in the media quite a bit. I saw there was an article on Sky Sports, and there's been you've been on other websites and things because of your new book, No Final Whistle.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's kind of a bit all who you know, and once you get that initial interest, it's easy to make those connections. But The Boy in Brazil was a fantastic experience, and I really enjoyed the writing of it. I also really enjoyed actually trying to get the book out there and trying to sell it and trying to market it.
Mm-hmm.
I think 2 years after The Boy in Brazil came out, my publisher on that book, Ian Ridley, who's really like a mentor to me. Anything he says in writing, I'll do. If he thinks that my ideas are good, then I'll run with them.
Yeah.
The guy, and he came to me and said, look, I've had this story submitted to me, and I like the story, but I think it needs a bit of help with the writing. So I was a ghostwriter on a story called Thought Was Coming Out, which is a story of Neil Beasley. grassroots footballer, but he's also gay, and it's kind of his experience as a gay footballer is quite an interesting story for me to be a part of, because it was something I didn't really have much idea about.
Yeah.
So I did, and again, I really enjoyed the writing process. It was great, and I then spent about a year and a half working with a fairly well-known footballer on his autobiography as a ghostwriter. He's got an amazing story, really does. I love doing it, but unfortunately ran into some problems with libel, and so that never came out. And while we were to work around the libel, I thought, you know, I want to start a new writing project, but I don't want something that I have to commit to. I want to do something that I can kind of come back to every now and again. Mm. At that point, I've been going to schools and going into businesses and stuff and doing talks about my experiences in football, my experiences in writing. The problem was that in the books I've done so far, there were swear words, so I couldn't go into primary schools.
Yeah.
Well, a way around that would be to write a children's book, which is something I'd always really wanted to do, because growing up, I'd absolutely loved, you know, reading all those children's football books. I found them so inspirational. And so I decided to just play with some stories, and I ran one past Ian, and Ian really liked it. I thought there was some potential for it, so I started to submit it to publishers, and unfortunately got some offers, and the result was No Final Whistle, which is out this week, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the media's been good on it so far. It's been a topic. It's a topic close to my heart on youth development and academy football. But the main message is that you know, if one person says you're not good enough, that doesn't make it a fact. That's just their opinion. You can prove them wrong. I've used my own experiences of playing in academies to write a story, and the story itself is a true one that happened to me. And I hope that it inspires children and readers.
Yeah. I hope so. Yeah. I hope so too. It sounds like a great story. It kind of brings me back, actually, because I remember I used to read. I was trying to find it online actually earlier today. I couldn't find the particular series I used to read. I used to read quite a lot of sports book myself. I used to read a cricket series, Glory Gardens, as well.
I read all of those, and also the Hurricane Hamish books. I really loved. They're also cricket ones.
Yeah, it makes me think actually how like sort of inspirational sports books can be to children, and also as another element as well, getting children into reading, because for me I didn't particularly enjoy reading. It was reading sports books that got me interested, and I think, you know, getting kids into reading is obviously an important thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. It's getting them into reading, but also trying to build that power, that message of resilience, I think is a really important one, which is why I really wanted to write this book.
Mm.
And something that I really enjoyed, so yeah, I'll definitely be writing more children's books in the future.
Mm-hmm. And going back, I presume I'm not allowed to ask which footballer it was you were ghostwriter on.
No, but the libel issues are all sorted now, so his book will be coming out, unfortunately with a different writer, but it's going to be a really good book for sure.
Okay, fair enough. I'll drop that then. Alright, yeah. So yeah, there's No Final Whistle, and also The Boy in Brazil, which I'll definitely take a read of The Boy in Brazil, especially. Just going on from there, there's a few sort of news items I just want to look at that's going on at the moment. First of all, it's the transfer deadline day coming up. I just wondered what your thoughts are on for the Premier League anyway. The deadline has moved to this Thursday, so just before the season starts. Do you agree with it?
I mean, it's great for my fantasy football selection. I think it is good. I think it encourages managers to work with what they have, and also prevents panic buys. I think, you know, teams often start slowly or start too well, and I think with the transfer as it was, it encouraged panic buys based on we haven't scored in our first three games. We need to buy spend loads of money on a striker.
Yeah,
and it may, I mean, you know, limiting that movement may also have benefits to youth development moving forward, so I definitely think it's a positive move.
Mm. I agree with the principle of it, and I think you look back to last season and there were players like Van Dijk and a few others who were sort of refusing to play in the hope of getting or wanting a transfer, so that it should get rid of that, the fact the window closes before, or it does domestically anyway. I think the issue we've got is the fact that it's not a Europe wide. I think for it to work, there has to be a similar deadline all across Europe, not just England, for me.
Yeah, I 100% agree.
And as you say, that's exactly right. It unsettles players. It makes it hard for managers when they've got players who they know want away, and you know, somehow that can't happen. So, yeah, I think we should be introduced. UEFA should take it up and say that this has happened.
There's quite a few unsettled players over at Chelsea at the minute. It looks like Courtois going to Real Madrid, also Eden Hazard and Danny Drinkwater could be leaving. Chelsea looking a bit of a mess at the moment, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, Willian as well, right? And even Abramovich with his visa situation. It's going to be really interesting there. And I mean, it'll be interesting again if they can integrate some of the buyers they've had in recent years, which have been quite almost strange. I mean, you've got Ross Barkley, you've got Drinkwater, who are two very good players and haven't really played much. And again, everyone talks about the youth system there. You've got Chalobah, Loftus-Cheek. I mean, Chalobah's gone now, but you've got players of that calibre. So it'll be interesting to see if that opens the door for Tammy Abraham and Loftus-Cheek to get more minutes. Chelsea really are an interesting team. The manager's obviously very well thought of. It's going to be, I mean, they could finish 10th, they could finish 2nd or 3rd this season. It's going to be really interesting to see how they progress. Also, there's also like stories such as David Luiz, how he comes back into the team, whether the new manager can get Morata firing as he was in the start of the last season. It's going to be really interesting watching them.
Yeah, well, I saw all through pre-season, it's been David Luiz and the youngster Ethan Ampadu have started at centre-back for most of their pre-season games. So it shows something for his belief in youth if he does end up starting when the Premier League comes along.
Yeah, definitely.
In terms of young players, though, I think you're right. I think it must be very frustrating being an 18, 19-year-old at Chelsea with the lack of opportunity for any youngster there. Then,
yeah, I think they've got some of the best youngsters in the whole of Europe. Mm. And they need to start playing them, otherwise they'll go abroad. So, like, as you've seen with Jadon Sancho, for example, he's doing really well at Dortmund, who are a very good team. And their youngsters like that, their success in Europe will hopefully... The same with Adam Lookman, for example. He had a really good company, and I think it's on the English clubs to start playing these players, otherwise they'll follow in the footsteps of those who have gone abroad for success, and you'll see more players leaving the Premier.
Do you think that more English players should try their luck abroad?
Absolutely. I think you develop opportunities as a person and as a player are absolutely fantastic to learn from these different cultures. It matures you a lot on the pitch, it matures you a lot in life. And even if it's on loan, I think you learn a lot. It really is incredibly valuable. I think they always said about Jack Wilshere, for example, who's got amazing talent. But for me, if he went abroad when he was 21, he wouldn't be playing for West Ham right now. He'd be playing for a top team.
I completely agree. I think it would be better for the England team as well. I mean, you look at all the European sides, you know, the Germanys or Spain or whoever, and when they announce their squad, they have players playing in the Premier League, in La Liga, in Bundesliga, in wherever, whereas here every player, or maybe bar one, plays in the Premier League. And I think, you know, it seems a strange thing to say after a great World Cup for England, but I think it would be more beneficial to England as well.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. By playing especially leagues like La Liga and the Bundesliga, I think it can only benefit national teams to have those different styles and those different cultures integrated into the national team itself.
And England itself at the World Cup, I presume you watched that, and you must have enjoyed it as much as I did.
Oh, I absolutely loved it. I really did. It's the first major tournament that hasn't really been disappointment in my life, I guess. My first World Cup I can remember is 98, so yeah, it's absolutely loved it, although I got swept up in it, and now looking back on it, I'm a bit disappointed because that Croatia team really was there for the taking, and I can't see that we'd have beaten France, but I really think we should have beaten Croatia and got to the final. Great performances, and you know, Southgate is absolutely fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that England team, and also as you mentioned, you know, the under-21s, the under-20s and such are doing very well at the moment, do you think that sort of you know, if you're a younger player, you know, say a young teenager or something, do you think seeing all that that must be quite inspirational and something to look up to?
Oh yeah, definitely. I think the way that the young players have come into the team and perform well, and Southgate's obviously got
faith in those youngsters. Must be very inspirational for young players coming through. I think we just need a couple of more experienced heads. I think that's where we lost against Croatia, is that a lot of these young players suddenly realised the enormity of, you know, we're 45 minutes away from the World Cup final, and they kind of let that pressure get to them. And I think if you add in a couple of experienced heads, which, to be honest, a lot of them will be in 4 years' time, like say Jordan Henderson, then I think that's a really good mix and could do very well in the tournaments to come.
I also just want to mention the Football League. You mentioned Peterborough being your side. I saw they won their opening game of the season 2-1. What are sort of the hopes for this season? I know last season you just finished just outside the playoffs. Is it trying to get promoted this season?
It's certainly trying to get promoted, but it's also kind of a case of not a clue. There's been a lot of movement in Peterborough. They've literally got a whole new team. They've got a new manager. And for the last probably 8 or 9 years, the philosophy has very much been getting these gems from non-league and playing very attacking, entertaining football. Yeah, there's always been a lot of goals at Peterborough. And this season, they've gone for a totally different change. They've got Steve Evans in, who is kind of liked and loved and hated in equal measure. But you can't say that he doesn't do well at that level of football. He's very good at getting teams promoted. Not the most aesthetically pleasing football, I guess. It's quite long ball. He's brought in a lot of players who are experienced in Football League rather than players from non-league. He's moved out a lot of players. I think we've had 17 players in this season, so it really is a whole new team. I think there are maybe only 2 or 3 players in the starting 11 from last season on Saturday. So it'll be interesting to see. I do think the fans kind of have a bit of a... They think that Peter is a big club and what it is. People do forget that before... It all changed for Peterborough when there was a show called Big One Manager in around 2006, I think, where the Sky One programme, Ryan Atkinson came in to try and improve Peterborough's hopes. That was the whole kind of idea behind the show. As part of that, they included the academy, so we got to be part of the show, which was really cool. But as a result of that show, they found an investor, Darren McCampion, his chairman, who is an absolutely wonderful chairman. He's really well loved by supporters. And since he started putting some money in, Peter have transformed from being a bit of a yo-yo club between League 2 and League 1 to being a club who are top, looking at playoffs every season in League 1, maybe even getting to the Championship every now and again. So they've been transformed, but I think since they've been promoted to the Championship, these fans now expect Peter to be promoted every season. Whereas you kind of look at where Peterborough were 10 years ago and consider that we came up near the table last season, and a lot of fans weren't happy with that. I think they kind of need a bit of perspective, I guess. Also, my company is taking a bit of a step back from it, so it'll be interesting to see what happens with Peterborough, because it's changing philosophy this season. I think changes on the horizon, and whether the club can maintain their successes on crowds of 5,000-6,000 will be interesting to see.
As I recall, last season, Steve Evans took over sort of halfway through, and then there was a bit of an upturn in form, and then a bit of a collapse at the end, and I think they lost like 5 or 6 games in a row, something like that, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it is hard to, when you're playing for nothing, to get motivation. So, yeah, I think it's hard to read into the games. I just wipe it clean and start from the season, especially now Steve Evans has brought in his own players. And the club's got a very clear direction under him, whether or not that's what fans agree with. I mean, and to be honest, a lot of fans are on board with Steve Evans. I think there were quite a lot in the crowd who were growing a bit tired of taking part in non-league players. It'll be interesting to see what happens. And he wouldn't have been my choice. I think there are a lot of more interesting candidates. Like, I know that Mark Warburton, for example, was being talked about. But I suppose he was a safe option, so let's see how he does, and hopefully he gets Peterborough into the promotion mix this season.
Who do you see as the main rivals in there? I mean, it's a very competitive division, and Sunderland are the obvious favourites. So, who else do you think will be up there come the end of the season?
There's some big clubs. There really are. I think they played Charlton in there the other day, Sunderland. They should be in and around the mix there. I'm not too sure to be honest. Wait and see for this season.
Just as a final question, in your book No Final Whistle, there's a foreword from Sam Clucas.
Yeah.
So you played with him earlier in your career, I believe, in youth football somewhere.
Yeah. So when I got released by Peterborough and signed for Stamford, I went for trials for Lincolnshire to represent the county after that, and I was successful. And Sam Plukes was also successful. He was playing for Nettleham in the Lincolnshire League, and I was always playing for Stamford. And we played down the left-hand side, so I'd play a left-back and he'd play a left-wing. So obviously got to know him through there. And his rise has been incredible, really has. And I think that really kind of emphasises about how players mature and develop at different rates. Because he was a good player back then, but you could never see him playing the Premier League. But obviously he's gone to amazing things, and you watch him play now, and he really is a very, very, very good player. So it's been great to play alongside him, and also the forward that he wrote was fantastic. Just saying about how, as I discussed, I guess, in that when he got released from Leicester, it's like his world ended, and he thought all people made sacrifices for him. You know, his parents driving him an hour and a half there, an hour and a half back each train session. You know, his parents taking time off work to try and push him to get a professional contract there. And just him saying about how, you know, most people don't make it, so just make sure you have fun when you play football. And he also said what the whole book's about, in that one person's opinion isn't fact. So just because one person says you're not good enough or says that you're not for them doesn't mean that that's true, and so that you can still work hard to prove them wrong, as he's done with his whole career.
Mm-hmm. No, he's a terrific player. I first became aware of him just as he joined Hull. And yeah, it looks like he might potentially be leaving Swansea and moving to a Premier League club. It's not really clear where he's going to end up playing next season.
No, but yeah, he belongs in the Premier League. He really does. And I'd love to see him back in that league again.
Mm-hmm. Seeing players like Lucas and Jamie Vardy and players like that, it shows that there's many pathways, I think, to get into the Premier League. It's not just you have to be at Man United or Tottenham or an academy like that. You can get there through the non-leagues and work your way up.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you saw that statistic about the England World Cup team, about how most of them come from teams like Milton, MK Dons, Sheffield United.
Mm.
And seeing that kind of really, again, is inspirational for young footballers around, showing that, just because you're not playing for Man United at the moment, it doesn't mean you can't ever make it to the highest level.
Mm.
And I think the more those stories come to light, the more, the better it will be for young aspiring footballers.
I think something's definitely changed in the last few years to make it that way, I think.
Yeah, I think it's just kind of football being more discoverable, like the internet, scouting, everything's becoming more sophisticated. So it means that people are able to, you're always being watched in football. Even when you're playing part football, there's always someone watching you, and you never know what can happen.
Mm.
And I mean, that's why children's football books are often do so well, because they talk about subjects like that about, and though they obviously exaggerate stories, that they are true. You could be playing in the park and then 10 years later playing for England. Those stories do actually happen.
Uh-huh. That sounds like a great place to end the show there. Thanks for coming on the show tonight.
Brilliant, thanks for having me.
All right, thanks for listening, and goodbye.